Tax update for August 26, 2007. This is the tax update for August 26, 2007. This week, North to Alaska, Thompson valuation and reasonable cause. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and firm matters raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.linebergservices.com. This week, we're going to look at an appellate case from the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that deals with two significant issues and one minor issue when it reviewed the tax court's opinion in the estate of Thompson, originally Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2004-174. The tax court decision on the valuation for the estate was generally accepted by the Court of Appeals with one mechanical adjustment that was made to the valuation. But the Court of Appeals did take a look at two substantial issues that had been raised, one by the IRS and one by the estate, on appeal of the tax court's decision. The Second Circuit agreed with the IRS that the tax court had not properly decided the question of whether the taxpayer was subject to the substantial understatement of tax penalty for a valuation of understatement on their estate tax return, but disagreed with the taxpayer's contention that due to the fact the burden of proof had been shifted under Section 7491, the tax court was required to either adopt the IRS's expert's opinion essentially in whole or rather resort to the taxpayer's expert opinion. The court disagreed with that position and turned down the taxpayer's appeal on that point. Now, it's an interesting and odd little case sitting back there, and let's take a look at some of the facts behind the Thompson case here. And just to confuse matters a bit, we're going to deal with two closely related names, Thompson and Thomas. Thompson is the decedent in this case. That is Josephine Thompson. Josephine owned 20% value in a closely held company. The company is Thomas Publishing. Now, on May 2nd, 1998, Josephine passed away. Now, Thomas Publishing published business-to-business manufacturing and industrial directories and publications in paper form, but was in the position, essentially, of transitioning over to an electronic format during that time period. Now, during the 1990s and just prior to Josephine's death, the company, in fact, experienced an upsurge in their revenue as they converted from what had previously been a fully paper-based situation over to a service that relied upon CDs at first and then the Internet. In fact, as time had went on, they first published their guide in CD format to subscribers. Then they turned around and freely provided their information on the Internet, relying heavily on advertising to generate their revenue. Now, by 1998, per the date of Josephine's death, the Court of Appeals noted that this website was ranked as the sixth most important, shall we say, business-to-business website in the United States. The company's revenues, as I noted, had continued to increase in the various years prior to Josephine's death. However, their expenses had gone up by about the same level. Nevertheless, the company continued to be very consistently profitable in all the years leading up to Josephine's death, and their revenue was growing rapidly, and arguably it appeared there was an investment in technology being made, but that investment would turn around and pay off down the line when the revenues would hopefully stay put, but the technological investment could go back down and the company would have fewer expenses now and still be able to deliver out their product and basically get their advertising for this directory. Now, revenue from paper products, we should note, dropped pretty dramatically during that same period. But that wasn't our problem since, of course, the online revenue was growing. Now, it's important to remember this was the mid to late 90s. During that period through 1998, that was a period, if you remember, the Internet, when the big push at that point was the theory that we were going to all use vertical market portals. And there was a real push among organizations, and not the least of which was the AICPA, you remember, with the CPA to Biz project. but various organizations to become the portal for the various industries or various areas or interest areas that would index the information or basically provide kind of a quickie little, you know, lookup resource to give you a directory of information of importance in various items on the net. And there was a lot of money rushing toward that and a lot of advertising, the theory being that the eyeballs would go there. If I had, for instance, let's take CPA to Biz in that case, I'm an accountant, I have an interest in accounting topics, tax topics, let's say that kind of background, I would make CPA to Biz my primary website. That would be my homepage. And therefore, if you wanted to advertise and get my attention, you could buy advertising on that website. And that would allow them to basically aggregate eyeballs that are going to be very interested to the advertiser, or at least that was the theory at the time. Now, one particular problem happened a few months after Josephine's death. In September of 1998, there was a little thing that happened in California that turned out to be very important for this purpose and got us out of this whole portal business and into a whole different concept of how people would handle the web. And in that particular date, Larry Page and Sergey Brin basically incorporated a tiny little company in California known as Google. And Google changed the whole way we look at this stuff. We no longer worried about the portals as Google began to grow and their indexing system became better. The whole theory that we were all going to be going to these vertical market portals where I would be an accounting portal, attorneys would be at a law firm portal, legal portal, and, you know, engineers would be an engineering portal. Rather, Google was able to get everybody essentially to start putting their page as the homepage. And that particular change came just after Josephine died. We begin to see the effect of this, for in the years following Josephine's death, the fortunes of Thomas Publishing began to go downhill. In fact, the revenues began to decline, but expenses did not decline. By the year 2001, the company had gone from net income of $18 million in 1998, the year when Josephine had passed away, an income that frankly was fairly consistent for the number of years prior to Josephine's death. The tax court gives us five previous years, and the income is in that range each of the years, to a net loss of nearly $14 million, followed by, in 2002, as a paired cost, a break-even year. So the company went from a consistently profitable position to a barely break-even position as their paper business had disappeared, and now Google was removing the whole theory of the portals and, to a certain extent, removing much of the drive to advertise on this particular portal site for a business-to-business directory. Now, that's the background we've got. Obviously, in one sense, for valuation purposes, since we're concerned with the value at the date of death, shall we say Josephine had extremely poor timing in her death, because she apparently died at a point at which the company would arguably have been worth a lot more than it would have been perhaps before that date or after that date. But nevertheless, her advisors went out and had to obviously file a gift tax return, or I should say the estate's advisors. So the estates went out and hired advisors to handle the valuation. Now, they made an interesting choice in finding their advisors. It turns out that even though the decedent was located in New York, the company was located in New York, the advisors they chose came from Alaska. Now, it was kind of interesting how the estate found this particular attorney. And the attorney in this point, Mr. Gehrig. Now, Mr. Gehrig essentially was brought in, even though he is an attorney, he was brought in as the valuation expert. And Mr. Gehrig turned around and brought in an accountant from Alaska, a Mr. Wicherick, who also would become involved in this valuation. Now, why did they go to Alaska? Well, the estate admitted in the case that the reason they had picked the Alaska attorney and to represent the estate, you know, basically to value the stock owned by TPC or Thompson Publishing Company stock, and to represent the estate's administrator of the estate, was to have the audit of the estate tax return conducted not by the New York office of the IRS, but rather by the Alaska office. Mr. Gehrig believed and apparently told the estate that he would be able to obtain a more favorable valuation of the estate stock if he did the valuation and if he had the case handled in Alaska as opposed to having it handled in New York. Now, how did they discover this gentleman? Since it seems odd for a New York attorney, for a New York estate to stumble onto a attorney from Alaska. Well, it turns out that there was an attorney for Josephine's family who had met Mr. Gehring on a fishing trip. And apparently this is what developed to bring Mr. Gehring to become the valuation expert for the estate, as well as becoming its representative and taking care of running the estate from Alaska. Now, as noted, Mr. Gehring retained the services of Paul Warchek, an Alaska accountant who valued it. Now, they prepared the valuation report that was submitted with the estate tax return. When they finished, they determined the value of her interest in Thompson in Thomas Publishing was $1,750,000. Now, a key factor in their valuation, there is a number of them, but they used a rather aggressive set of discount rates, discounts. Plus, in computing the capitalization rate, they include a 12% addition to their discount factor for the risks to Thomas Publishing related to the internet to technology and the loss of advertising revenue that might be related here thereto, including the perceived risks in TPC's management structure. Now, the tax court had a number of problems with this valuation, beginning with the advisor themselves and their qualifications. As for Mr. Gehring, they noted he was a lawyer with an audit and tax dispute resolution practice. He also did tax return preparation, and apparently he also did occasional valuations. He was very much, Renaissance man in terms of practice, it appears. From his resume, the court, though, concluded that he appears to have attended a limited number of appraisal courses other than some courses that he took while he worked for the IRS a number of years earlier. So it was kind of interesting that he did not appear to have a great background to be the person doing the actual valuation. It's important to note that while he was an attorney, he was the primary person doing the valuation itself. He was not an attorney who hired a valuation expert. He was the valuation expert for this estate. Now, he did have assistance from Mr. Wycherick, who, according to the court, provided accounting and tax preparation services, does some business consulting, and undertakes an occasional valuation for small businesses. And the court noted, generally, Mr. Wycherick's valuations were in the context of divorce and property settlement disputes. He belonged to no professional organizations or associations related to his appraisal or valuation work. Now, the court had real problems with the work of these two. And the court noted that although they admitted into evidence the valuation reports and treated them as credible, the tax court regarded the report and the testimony of the experts to be only marginally credible. Gehring and Wycherick were barely qualified, according to the court, to value a highly successful and well-established New York City-based company with annual income in the millions of dollars. So the court, to put it mildly, was not impressed with the estate's advisors. The one piece of good news for the estate was it turned out that the court wasn't terribly impressed with the IRS's valuation experts as either. Now, a big problem that the court had, though, with these two was that technology discount. Because it would certainly appear that to a large extent this was operating for 2020 hindsight, we needed a discount. But the court noted, and I think we all remember, that in 1998 it was difficult to find anybody who would have thought that that was a real negative. Instead, that was a real positive driving values up. This is before the dot-com bubble burst, and when valuations were being driven up higher and higher as long as you had something to do with technology. And here not only was a firm that had technology, but it also had what really drove people in that period was top-line dollars. In those years, a key factor for determining the value of a company was how many people did you get to your site and what was the top-line revenue. We didn't worry much about the bottom line, but this company appeared to be attracting advertisers. And in fact, unlike many web-based companies, this particular company had a web strategy that currently was actually making them profitable. So the court was saying that in 1998, it seemed unlikely that a willing buyer would have been concerned with a technological risk factor in this company. In fact, if anything, they would have been more likely to give it a technological boost. The court was also concerned because the two valuation experts for the estate, even though they put this risk factor in, did nothing in terms of projecting the potential for greater income down the line that would come from that greater risk that had been taken on through this investment in capital. Now, what the court noted was they said there are a number of factors that suggest that 12% factor was not correct. They noted that TPC paid out cash dividends to its stockholders in excess of $7 million, a significant increase over the cash dividends paid out to stockholders in prior years, and inconsistent, the court noted, with any management perception that as of May 1998, or in the near future, that they faced extraordinarily risky additional internet and technology-related expenditures that would lower the value of the company. They said TPC's 98 cash dividends, the court notes, particularly in light of the lower level of stock trail dividends been paid in prior years, are indicative of an optimistic management outlook for May of 98. And the court did not find that TPC was mismanaged during this time frame. They found that management was apparently competent and doing a relatively decent job during that period. Now, but the court, as we note, while they weren't happy with this valuation, nor with the discounts that were taken, which appeared to be somewhat aggressive for minority discounts and other, the standard discounts taken in a valuation case, they were not terribly happy with the IRS's expert. In fact, the court said that the IRS's valuation appears to be concerned with numbers only and did not make an effort to base his valuation of TPC on a real company. It noted his sterile reports is reflected both in a comparable public company analysis and in his discounted cash flow analysis. The tax court found that his 11 comparable public companies weren't really very comparable at all, except they were vaguely in a business line that was somewhat related in some indirect sense to what TPC did. As well, the court rejected the theory that no minority discount should be allowed whatsoever. At the end of the day, the tax court made its own finding. Now, the IRS, as you may remember, we told you that the estates expert said it was worth $1,750,000 was Josephine's share. The IRS's expert said that the valuation of her share was actually $32 million, significant increase. The tax court made its own finding, and it decided at the end of the day the proper value was $13,525,240. Now, that value, however, and the Sixth Circuit and both parties in this case agree that if you accept the way the tax court computed valuation, this value was overstated. In fact, the IRS concedes that if this methodology was correct, the valuation is overstated by $1.2 million. The taxpayers did not make any such statement, but they agreed there was an error. Now, the taxpayers didn't come up with a number because they were hoping for another solution that would get them back to their valuation so they wouldn't worry about the courts. But nevertheless, aside from that potential $1.2 million adjustment or whatever that adjustment may end up being once the tax court goes back and refigures its numbers, the valuation, you know, the Second Circuit Court found that the valuation appeared to be a correct valuation, that they had no problem with what the tax court had come to its conclusions. Now, the problem the tax court had, just to summarize quickly, was that they treated $68 million in short-term investments as non-operating assets and added the $68 million to the capitalized income. But the tax court, the Second Circuit noted the tax court in error had not removed the income generated by the $68 million, so they essentially double-counted the $68 million. If you both capitalize the income on those assets plus add the assets in, they're being counted twice. So the court said we needed to make an adjustment for that, and the IRS concedes that that adjustment would drop the value in the estate by a little over $1 million. Now let's get to our two key issues on appeal. Well, basically, as noted, we had the conceded issue there of the valuation, so it's going to go back to the tax court to have to be revalued under that point if we have a valid valuation. However, the taxpayer contended that, in fact, the tax court erred by using and coming up with that valuation because everyone had agreed, apparently we'd conceded, that the burden of proof had been shifted under Section 7491. Now, Section 7491A1 provides that if in any court proceeding a taxpayer introduces credible evidence with respect to any factual issue relevant to ascertaining the liability of the taxpayer for any tax imposed by Subtitle A or B, the secretary shall have the burden of proof with respect to such issues. And there was no question here about a lack of cooperation that would have thrown this out under Section 7491A2 and its particular limitations paragraphs. The question of the valuation was a factual issue. And the tax court kind of grudgingly agreed that they had presented credible evidence, had accepted the valuation report. It may think their particular valuation experts weren't the most qualified in the world and maybe didn't do the greatest job in the world, but they didn't totally reject the report and say it was totally something they just weren't going to pay any attention to. They did work from that particular document. Now, the IRS, therefore having the burden of proof, submitted their own valuation report. The tax court did not accept that valuation report. The tax court said that, or they accepted, at least, shall we say, in terms of not accepted, they certainly didn't adopt it as their position. So the tax court did not say it was worth $32 million. They had significant problems with how the IRS's expert had valued the particular property. And the tax court, in fact, when they came up with their valuation, while it wasn't terribly close to either party's valuation, it was closer to the taxpayer's expert valuation than it was to the IRS's expert valuation. Now, the estate had argued, as a Second Circuit note, that the commissioner necessarily failed to satisfy his burden. They contend that under Section 7491, once the tax court had rejected the valuation offered by the commissioner, the tax court had to adopt the valuation given by the taxpayer. That, in essence, it was an all-or-nothing situation. Either the tax court accepted the valuation of the commissioner's expert to overcome the burden of proof, or they had to go back and accept the valuation of the taxpayer's expert, since with the burden of proof being there, it was kind of a tie goes to the taxpayer. If both of these are kind of off and not great, but we accepted the taxpayers to come in, we have to go back to $1,750,000. Now, the Second Circuit Court did not agree with that. The court specifically pointed out that prior to the enactment of Section 7491, that basically there was a presumption that the commissioner's determination was correct. Now, they noted that the presumption even then did not require the tax court to adopt the taxpayer's valuation, however erroneous, whenever the tax court rejects the commissioner's proposed value. The burden of disproving the taxpayer's valuation can be satisfied by evidence in the record that impeaches, undermines, or indicates error in the taxpayer's valuation. The court noted that, in fact, back a number of years ago, in 1976, the Second Circuit had specifically said the tax court could, under that theory, where the burden of proof was on the IRS, that the tax court was not basically limited to taking one or the other of the valuations, that the tax court had the right to make an independent determination that would not agree with either party. The fact that the burden had shifted did not, in and of itself, change the fact that the tax court still could make its independent determination of the amount. Now, it makes an interesting comment in a footnote where it raises and then refuses to answer the question of what if the tax court, rather than, because as it points out, the tax court had accepted some of the IRS's arguments about why the taxpayer's valuation was flawed. What if the tax court had rejected the IRS's arguments or the IRS had failed to argue? Would the tax court have then been stuck with having to accept the taxpayer's valuation, even if the tax court, from looking at the record, came to the conclusion that that valuation was an error? The Second Circuit holds that since that wasn't the question in front of them, they didn't have to deal with that issue at this time, and they did not deal with that issue. So the tax court is sustained on this matter, and the estate has a little problem there. So the estate's going to get a different value, going to get the valuation, and it'll be reduced slightly, it looks like, due to the recalculation. But now we go back to the question we have to deal with, which was the IRS's appeal. The IRS had been concerned about the valuation penalty under Section 6662. That there had been a substantial valuation understatement reported on the estate. That, in fact, at the time, the question was basically, you know, a substantial understatement. If the claim value of the estate ended up being, under the rules then, we now have new rules at the Pension Protection Act, not more than 25% of the amount determined to be correct, the taxpayer must pay an accuracy related penalty of 40% of the underpayment. Now, the $1.75 million was less than 15% of the value determined by the court to be correct. Therefore, mechanically, 6662 would require the 40% penalty on the underpayment to be imposed. The court notes, though, the only exception to that rule is the reasonable cause provision, where if there is a reasonable cause for the taxpayer's understatement, that the penalty can be waived. And it notes under Section 6664C1 that you need to show there was reasonable cause for the underpayment and that the taxpayer acted in good faith with regard to the underpayment. Now, the tax court had decided that the taxpayers did not owe this. They found that there was reasonable cause to basically abate the penalty. And the tax court held that the valuation of the 20% interest in stock was difficult and unique, that there weren't comparable companies to TPC that, you know, weren't out there. Nobody had found them, the IRS nor the estate's advisors. And the valuation of the 20% interest under capitalization of income and discounted cash flow method involved a number of difficult judgment calls. The tax court noted specifically that they thought it was significant that even the IRS's expert had made a number of significant errors in their valuation calculation. So the tax court said, look, we have two valuation experts and they both fouled this up. This is not a simple thing to value. Now, the court went on to note that certainly the experts for the estate were aggressive in their low valuation of TPC. It then goes on to note the IRS's expert was similarly aggressively overvalued the value of the interest in question. The tax court notes that their actual value was closer to the estate's expert's value than the IRS expert's value. And based upon that record, the tax court held that no penalty should be assessed. But the Second Circuit did not accept that the tax court had properly applied the law in determining whether or not a waiver was appropriate. The Second Circuit has the issue here of the fact that the tax court, to its view, did not apply the actual regulations involved in determining what is a good, reasonable cause and a good faith effort. The court notes that under the regulations, the existence of reasonable cause is determined by a case-by-case basis, taking into account all facts and circumstances. The reg goes on to note at 1.6664-4B1 that the most important factor is the effect of the taxpayer's effort to assess the taxpayer's proper tax liability. Reliance on the appraiser does not necessarily demonstrate reasonable cause and good faith. But such reliance, continuing on in the reg, does satisfy reasonable cause if under the circumstances such reliance was reasonable and taxpayers acted in good faith. Thus, continuing on, the reliance on the expert's opinion may not be reasonable good faith if the taxpayer knew or reasonably should have known that the advisor lacked knowledge in the relevant aspects of federal tax law. I think the tax court was concerned with, I think the Second Circuit was concerned with the fact the tax court had basically found these advisors to be barely credible and had indicated a number of potential problems with their stated qualifications, issues that, from the Second Circuit's view apparently, should have factored into the tax court's decision on whether it was reasonable to accept the valuation of these appraisers. The court specifically notes the tax court found these experts demonstrated no experience with internet and technology-related companies and were too inexperienced, accommodated, and biased in favor of the estate. Given that factual background, the Second Circuit panel appeared skeptical about the tax court's decision that it was reasonable to accept that valuation. But the court doesn't really direct the tax court to find the penalty applies. Rather, it says that the tax court's fines are insufficient to support a determination of reasonable cause under Section 6664. It basically orders the tax court to go back now and determine, was it reasonable to rely on the statements of these experts and the valuation of these experts, given what the taxpayer knew about these experts and how the taxpayer had turned around and decided to hire this particular set of experts. That is there reasonable cause? The Second Circuit does not appear to think it is relevant in any way, shape, or form, the fact that the IRS's own expert came up with a much higher value. Reality is that the particular code provisions and the regulations don't really impose any such duty on the IRS's advisor to be similarly reasonable, Rather, the real burden comes down the taxpayer. This was a concern that was raised with the Pension Protection Act and continues to be an issue in the penalties. But nevertheless, the Second Circuit does appear to be properly applying the law in this regard, that our concern is not with whether the IRS appraiser got it wrong, but rather with whether the taxpayer's appraisal was basically so far out of line that the taxpayer should have said this simply is too good to be true. Now, the case outlines a couple of important points. First, it's important not to overestimate the usefulness of the burden shift under Section 7491, which was what they attempted to do in this case, or attempted to argue. While we prefer to have the shift take place, it's much better to have the burden on the IRS than on the taxpayer. You may not accomplish a whole lot once that's done. General rule seems to be primarily that it's not very often when you read tax court cases that we come down to the question of who had the burden of proof, and that's how we decided which way the case went. Rather, normally the evidence comes out strongly on one side or the other, at least in the tax court's view, and based upon that, the tax court rules in the way the court does. In this particular case, they basically said, we don't accept what either one of you said, and we rather came up with our own methodology for determining what the proper value should be. Second, the case also, I think, emphasizes the importance of having qualified advisors on your team when we're dealing with an estate tax or even a charitable contribution valuation issue. In this particular case, the other thing didn't help was the apparent smell problem that they were intentionally shopping to hopefully find a set of IRS offices that apparently they thought they had some sort of in with by using these advisors. These advisors did not appear to have any stated qualifications that made them particularly well qualified to take this on, at least not in the court's view. And the reality was that apparently what they had said was essentially that we could provide you with a lower valuation than you're going to get if you go ahead and let this go through New York. For that reason, it looks a lot like opinion shopping. And the courts don't tend to like opinion shopping, to put it mildly, and especially with the question of penalty relief. But reality was, even if we accept that there was a strong reason to not want the case to be heard by the New York office of the IRS, so we want to go ahead and have it taken care of in Alaska, it seems difficult to believe that there were not competent advisors or more competent advisors available in Alaska or somewhere else in the country that could have handled this appropriately. It appeared that the only real decision point for handling this set of advisors, at least the way the court seems to phrase it, was the mere fact that they were in Alaska, not in New York, and that was the key qualification that the estate appeared concerned with. If the court looks at it that way, then it would seem very, very likely that it's going to be difficult to find that they reasonably relied on these appraisers, since their reliance would have been based primarily upon geographically where they were located, not exactly a factor that would argue for a reasonable method of determining who's going to be able to properly value this particular piece of property. Again, while it may make sense or may not, and it's a little bit of concern when you have a case that appeared to have been intentionally shopped its way out of New York, but even if you decide that was a valid reason, you certainly still could find many, many competent individuals anywhere else in the country besides New York who could have handled this matter. And obviously, I would say we could find very many competent individuals in the state of Alaska that could have handled this if it's that important to make sure it took place in Alaska. So we have to make sure that clients understand the need to properly consider the qualifications of the advisors they are working with. Now, this has been the Tax Update for August the 26th, 2007. The Tax Update, as normal, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them for information of interest to tax professionals. And this has been the Tax Update.